in 1 hour. Everybody ready? You know, like fast rides? We're going to spend 20 minutes on each section of six chapters. So 20 minutes on the first six chapters, 20 minutes on the middle six chapters, 20 minutes on the last six chapters. And the first six chapters of Bhagavad Gita deal primarily with who am I, what do I do? It's about the self and about karma yoga. The middle six chapters deal primarily with who is God and how do I perform bhakti yoga. And the last six chapters deal primarily with what is nature. So self, God, and nature in those three sections. And is it possible to get some water?
Okay.
One cup. So Bhagavad Gita starts off on a battlefield with a description of an about to start war. This was a civil war. The people on the main combatants on each side were cousins and all the armies who supported them. So Arjuna's on the side, he's one of the younger brothers of Yudhisthira, who was actually crowned emperor of the world. Thank you so much. And was a righteous leader. However, through various political maneuvers, cheating, and out and out nefarious activities, their cousins Duryodhan and his company had taken over the rulership. So Arjuna and his brothers were not interested in ruling for their own self. They were actually happy in any situation, but they were interested in ruling because Krishna wanted them to rule so that they could elevate people in general and take proper care of them. So this is the run, the right on the battlefield, and the war is just about to begin. This was 5,000 years ago, so these were the days in which wars did not involve civilians and they didn't involve populated areas, that battles took place according to rules of combat away from the general populace. And one of the rules was that the war only started once it was announced that, okay, the war is about to start. In fact, even individual battles were like that. When individual soldiers were fighting with each other, at first they'd say, "Beware, beware, I'm about to fight with you." So they wouldn't hit them from behind or just drop something from the sky in the middle of the night or hit non-combatants, etc. So at this point, everybody was ready. We were waiting for the signal. And the signal started with the blowing of conch shells on either sides. That, okay, now we're ready to fight. But at this point, Arjuna said to Krishna, who was driving Arjuna's chariot, and that in and of itself would be a very long discussion. How God enjoys being the servant of his devotee. So we are asked to become the servant of Krishna. And generally in this world, if you become the servant of anyone, at least in modern Western countries, that's not considered a very nice position. Hardly anybody here in the West anymore has servants. If you go to third world countries, you'll find that most people from lower middle class on up have servants. But here, only the wealthiest people have servants, isn't it? It's rare for people to have a servant. Maybe you have someone comes in once a week and cleans your house or something like that. But as far as regular servants, we have replaced most of our human servants with mechanical and electrical servants. And then we have unemployment. That's another discussion. But anyway, we don't like this concept of being a servant. However, being a servant of Krishna is lovely. And it's so lovely that even Krishna himself likes to be a servant. We shouldn't think of God as if he's some sort of a dictator, although he's called the transcendental autocrat. The main word there is transcendental, not autocrat. Because although Krishna is in one sense the final decider, like we had our former president, George W. Bush, who said he was the decider. So really the only decider is God. But even though Krishna is the ultimate decider and the ultimate autocrat, he actually likes taking orders from his devotees. He's not so interested in just being the big boss. So he's here as Arjuna's chariot driver, which is a servant position. And Arjuna says, Senaya Ubayor Madhye, you please take me in the middle of the two armies. And when Arjuna looks around and he sees that there are friends and relatives on both sides, even though the war was justified, if war can ever be justified, this was a justified war, he started shaking and crying. He was overwhelmed with grief. And he said, I don't want to fight this war. He said, Govinda, I shall not fight. Now, of course, most of us are not literally in a war. I mean, I know I have some friends who are in the military and who have literally been in a war in Afghanistan or Iraq. But most of us are not in a war. However, I would say that most of us are in situations in our life that feel like lose-lose. So this is what Arjuna said. He said, it's lose-lose. He said, if I win, it will be at the cost of killing so many people and people who are dear to me, people that I care about, people who are in my own family. So even if I win, I won't be able to get any benefit out of winning. I won't be able to enjoy what I win. My spoils will be tainted with blood, he said. And just even from a practical point of view, if you get something nice, you want to share it with your family. You don't want to get something nice by killing your family. He said, so I'm not going to get any pleasure out of this. And then he said, I should be compassionate, even though the people on the other side are evil, even though they're greedy, even though they've harmed so many of the citizens, even though they've done so many unlawful and sinful things. I should be compassionate and forgiving. And then what about sin? He said, isn't war in general sinful? What to speak of if I'm killing relatives? And not only relatives. Arjuna's father had died when Arjuna was very young. And Arjuna was raised by his great uncle, Bhishma. They all called him grandfather, although Bhishma had no children. And Bhishma was on the other side. So he's basically like his stepfather, the man who had raised him when his father died. He was fighting on the opposite side. And Dronacharya, his teacher, who had taught him military science, he was on the other side. And not only were those people dear to him, and they were superior to him, but they were both actually saints. They weren't ordinary military persons. They weren't ordinary government persons. And he said, it would be so sinful to kill them. I can't fight with them. He said, better if I'm just standing here unarmed and unresisting and they kill me. Which for a soldier is outrageous. I can't do it, he said. And then he said, I'll destroy the family. And if all of the elders and the men of the family are destroyed, in those days women were rarely, not never, but rarely combatants. He said, if all the men of the family are destroyed, there'll be all these women without husbands, without fathers. They won't have proper protection, other people will take advantage of them, and society will become degraded. So these were his four arguments that he gave. He said, there won't be any pleasure for me in it. Shouldn't I be compassionate and forgiving? Won't I be overcome with sin? And I'm going to destroy society. So sometimes, as I say, we're in situations like this, we don't know which way to turn. We think, whatever decision I make, it's not going to turn out the way I want. In fact, we can say that in general in this material world, our situation is like that. Can we really say that our material decisions are going to work out just the way we want them? I mean, it happens occasionally that you make a decision, you say, yes, that was a perfect decision, everything just went wonderfully, and I'm so happy with that decision. But usually it's not like that. Usually we make our decisions and it's like, well, some parts of it were all right, and this wasn't so good, or I really wish I hadn't done that. It's very difficult in life to say, this is exactly what I should do to bring me happiness. Isn't that hard? I mean, whether it's a big decision, like buying a house, or where you're going to work, or who you're going to marry, or whether you're going to have a child, or whether it's a small decision, like do I go to the store today or tomorrow? Of course, you don't know. Sometimes whether you go to the store today or tomorrow may determine your whole rest of your life. I once missed getting in a severe car accident that would have either killed me or crippled me by literally 1 second. I was driving from Raleigh to Atlanta, and at the end of my trip, I was the only one on the highway, and a car came from the other side and bounced over the median and went right in front of my car, missed me by literally a yard, and bounced over into the woods. And I was thinking, oh, now my cell phone's over. That's because I'm not used to having one. I don't usually have cell phones. So for me, you know, whether I got in that car 5 minutes earlier or 5 minutes later, that was a big decision. I mean, how do we know even what are the big decisions and what are the little decisions? So this is our basic question in life. What do I do to become happy? What decisions do I make? How do I move? This is what we're asking all the time, really, whether we're asking it consciously or not. So therefore, this talk of the Bhagavad Gita is a talk for us. Although it was given in a situation that is a lot more extreme, on the one hand, than probably any of us will encounter in our life. So Arjuna first said to Krishna, I don't know what to do, I'm bewildered, I can't see any good, whatever decision I make will be bad, I'm just not going to fight. And he dropped his bow. And then he said, Krishna, I accept you as my guru. Now, as soon as Krishna was accepted as guru, the first words he said were in 2.11, asochyam, which means don't worry, don't lament. And we should mention that the last word of Krishna's instruction is also masuchaha, don't worry. Then after that, Krishna talks about who you can tell the Bhagavad Gita to. So from the moment that Krishna is accepted as guru to the end of his instruction, he says, don't worry, don't worry. Don't have anxieties. Be free from anxieties. Then Krishna explains as far as compassion, that compassion should be on the platform of the spirit. Of course, we should normally be compassionate on the bodily and mental and emotional level also. But if that's the only level on which one is compassionate, then that's not compassion at all. Srila Prabhupada compares that to saving only the clothes of a drowning man and not saving the drowning man. Now, obviously, if you save a drowning man, you will probably save his clothes as well. But your focus is not on the clothes, your focus is on the person. So real compassion should be on the level of the soul. In modern society, we have many programs to feed people and house people and train people and educate people and heal people on the platform of the body and the mind, which are all very good. But they're not sufficient. It's not enough. One has to get the real person. Another analogy we give is a bird in a cage. If you clean the cage, of course you want to clean the cage. You don't want to keep the bird in a dirty cage, but you also want to feed the bird. So if you only clean the cage, it's not enough. Or would you only put gasoline in your car? You also have to eat. And if we're going to look at the relative importance, then eating is more important than gasoline, and feeding the bird is more important than cleaning the cage, and saving the person is more important than saving the clothes. So first there has to be compassion on the spiritual level. And Krishna says, on the spiritual level, none of us are these bodies. Now, this point will be repeated later in more detail. But he starts off very beginning, you're not this body. This one fact changes everything, because all of our decisions in life start with our identity. Even if we're going to say that we weigh the pros and cons of something, it's all pros and cons in relationship to our identity. We think, I am this kind of a person, and therefore, these things are pleasing to me, and these things are not pleasing to me. My ideals, my values, my pleasures are all in relationship to my identity. Does that make sense to everybody?
Huh?
Just like the person in Syria and the person in Israel. One is thinking, well, because I'm an Israeli, therefore my values are to get the Syrians. And the person in Syria is thinking, because I'm Syrian, my value is to get the Israeli. It's based on identity. We're all, each of us are thinking, you know, I'm a mother. What does a good mother do? I'm an American. What does a good American do? I'm a liberal. What would a good liberal do? I'm a person who believes in this and this and this. I have this and this. Therefore, what should I do? And all of our decisions, everything, is based first and foremost on how we identify ourselves. Right? You notice in every kind of survey or research that somewhere in there there's what they call demographic data, right? What's your age? What's your gender? What's your income, maybe? Or what's your occupation? What's your nationality? What's your sense of identity? So Krishna says, guess what? Your real, that's right, children noises are fine. We don't mind children. Unless they're screaming. If they're screaming, they need to go scream someplace else. Just normal children noises. In case the rest of us forgot, we were all children. And as we go on and read Bhagavad Gita, we'll find out that many of us will again be children. So, no problem. Please treat him the way you want to treat me 50 years ago, because it will probably, 50 years from now, because that's probably where I will be. So, we are a spiritual being. And we cannot be harmed by weapons, we cannot be killed, we cannot actually be harmed in any way. And Krishna says that the real enjoyment comes from doing our duties for purification rather than for material sense gratification. Because Arjuna was saying, I'm not going to enjoy winning this kingdom. Krishna says, that's not where happiness comes from. Happiness comes from doing the right thing for the right reason. Not from having a lot around you to enjoy. Haven't we had experience of that? If we have a lot of nice things, but we haven't done the right things for the right reasons to get them, they're not as pleasurable as if we do the right things for the right reasons, even if we don't have as many nice things around us to enjoy. So Krishna says that's where happiness comes from. And he said the way you get rid of sin is by doing the right thing for the right reason. Acting properly. And what's the ultimate right reason? To reawaken our spiritual identity, to become purified. Then Krishna talks a lot about something that he calls Buddhi Yoga, or the Yoga of Intelligence. And he says this Buddhi Yoga means to unite our intelligence with Krishna, our source, our spiritual source, and to be absorbed in internal pleasure while offering our activities to Krishna as a sacrifice. So to unite our intelligence with Krishna, to be absorbed in internal pleasure, and to say, everything I'm doing, Krishna, I'm doing as a sacrifice for you. And Krishna says, such a person's activities look ordinary, but they're not. It's like the difference between day and night, this consciousness and material consciousness. Although externally, Arjuna will be fighting on the battlefield and then helping to rule the kingdom, and other people will be fighting. Externally, it's not a difference. Two people may be working in the same place or doing the same thing externally, but their experience will be totally different. And this point of sacrifice is very important. Krishna has an extraordinary statement that he makes. He says, the all-pervading transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. The all-pervading transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. So I'd like us to think for a moment, the last time that we did something that really enriched someone else's life and brought happiness to someone else. It shouldn't be hard to think of this because we've probably done it many times today. Done something, little thing, big thing, medium thing, to bring happiness to somebody else. And to just think for a moment, How did you feel? Pretty good, huh? Even if it's just a very small thing. Opening a door for somebody, thanking somebody, right? Going a little bit out of our way. That's called sacrifice. And that kind of sacrifice, that serving others and taking pleasure in the fact that I have done something to make someone else happy, being the means to make someone else happy, getting my happiness from the other person's happiness because of my behavior, that's our nature. That's called our Sanatana Dharma. We are designed, we are made to want to give happiness to others. And because everyone's designed like that, we'll also be happy. Our original position is that everyone is designed to get their happiness by making others happy. And even Krishna is designed like that because he's our source. So therefore Krishna says the all-pervading transcendence, that's Krishna, is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. So if there's one thing you get out of tonight's talk, if you get this, your whole life will change. That to do happy, willing sacrifice for the right person in the right way gives us everything we want. It's who we are. And Krishna says, working in such a spirit of sacrifice brings happiness to ourselves, brings happiness to others, and prevents society from degrading. Arjuna was particularly worried about an increase of illegitimate children. And Krishna says, actually, if you walk away from sacrifice and duty, you'll create illegitimate children in society. Just like in 1960, there was 4% of children were illegitimate, and now it's 40%. That's amazing, isn't it? Because we can see more and more in society this whole idea of doing your duty and sacrifice, it's not very much in fashion. It's just, you know, do what makes me happy now. And Krishna says, if you want to have actually loved and wanted children in society, in a stable society, then don't walk away from your duty. But do your duty, set that example. And Krishna says, even I do that. Even God himself does that. And please don't think that this doing one's duty out of sacrifice is some sort of heavy burden. It's joyful. Krishna himself is Satchit Ananda. He's full of joy. He's not going to do anything miserable. It's not like, I'm just going to do this duty out of sacrifice. It's something loving. And Krishna says, generally, when people give up their duties, it's not really due to renunciation and detachment, but it's due to lust. It's due to just, I want something for myself. The word lust or kama in the Bhagavad Gita doesn't just refer to sexuality. It refers to any time I'm thinking about I want something for myself no matter what the cost to myself and to others is. We could say that perhaps sexual lust epitomizes this mentality. Well, we saw this, especially you see some very famous person like our former President Bill Clinton or more recently, Tiger Woods, a good example. So somebody who, for their own enjoyment, they damage themselves. Damage others and damage themselves. But you think, you know, if you're a person in that kind of a position, why would you throw everything away? Isn't it? Interesting, isn't it? So that's the nature of lust. And although it's a particular problem with sexual lust, it's a problem with anything. Any kind of material thing that we're thinking, I want this no matter what the price. No matter what price other people around me pay, no matter what price I pay. And this is a very important point. The Krishna says, generally, when we walk away from responsibility, when we walk away from sacrifice, It's not because I'm a detached person, but it's due to lust. And he said, rather, one should act in the world, but in transcendental knowledge. Then Krishna talks about transcendental knowledge. And he says, I've explained this science. Krishna so far talked about two prongs of science. One is, I'm not this body. I should get spiritual happiness from within. Actually, I have nothing to do with this world. And the other is that one should do work as a sacrifice. And he said, I've explained both these branches of knowledge at the beginning of creation of the universe to the presiding deity of the sun. And Arjuna said, well, wait a minute, you're appearing on earth as my contemporary. How did you do that? So these sort of questions are wanted in spiritual life. I know one reason that I came to the Hare Krishna movement is within the religion of my family. When I asked too many questions, I was told by the religious leaders to be quiet. So Arjuna here is not being told to be quiet. When he says to Krishna himself, he says, wait a minute, you and I appear to be the same age. How could you have talked at the beginning of the universe to the sun god? So Krishna didn't say, you disrespectful person, what are you asking this question for? But he said, actually, you and I have taken birth many, many, many times, but I remember and you do not. And anyway, I am the transcendent Lord of everything. I am the origin of everyone. And then Krishna explains again, one should work for Krishna without material attachment. And Krishna says, but you know, however you deal with me, I will reciprocate. And Krishna explains that he set up systems of pious living called Varnashram in society for people who aren't ready for transcendence. And Krishna describes there at this part of the Bhagavad Gita all different ways one can sacrifice. And then he says, in order to understand one's particular way, one should approach a spiritual master. Because there's action that will elevate you, there's action that will degrade you, and then there's transcendent action. We call this karma, vikarma, and akarma. So karma gives you a nice material body, nice material situation. Vikarma gives you a bad material body, bad situation. Akarma gets you a spiritual body. It gives you freedom. And Krishna then says that everyone has their particular kind of activity that they're meant to do according to the body and mind that they have. And better to do that activity as a transcendent sacrifice than to give up work. The real question is changing your internal consciousness. So Krishna lists several things one should have as one's internal consciousness. First of all, that I, the soul, am just a witness. I, the soul, am just a witness. I'm not doing anything. I'm not sitting here, I'm not talking, I'm not blinking my eyes, I'm not drinking water, I'm not sleeping, I'm not doing anything, I'm just watching and desiring. How is that possible? Think about a computer game. And people are moving their characters in the computer game. Are they actually running and jumping and fighting and whatever they're doing? No. They're doing something. They're desiring and they're communicating their desires to the computer through some sort of interface. So exactly like that. And just like in a computer game, many people can be playing, right? Everybody here is familiar with computer games? You've at least seen somebody play them?
No.
You haven't seen anybody play them? Well, the scriptures compare this to a dream, but our experience here is collective. You know, if I dream about you, you're not having the same dream about me. So I'm able to see it as not real. But in the computer game, all the people's characters are interacting with each other, right? Correct? It's a shared illusory experience where a group of people all think I'm in this place doing this thing. So that's exactly what's happening here. This is a shared dream. It's a shared illusion. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It exists, just like a computer game exists. It's electricity, it's ones and zeros, it's bits of metal and plastic, right? It's something. You can't say it's nothing. But it's not what it appears to be. Or a movie. A movie exists. It's lights on a screen. or it's, you know, film of actors, but it's not what it appears to be. So our experience here in this world is not what it appears to be. It's called Maya, that which is not. So the first thing in consciousness is, I'm not doing these things. I'm only a witness and a desirer. Next thing in consciousness is that all of us spiritually are equal. One of the main things that we try to do in illusory consciousness, in materialistic consciousness, is posit ourselves as better than others. In some way. I try to think of some way in which I'm better than everybody I meet. Even if I'm indisputably in the presence of someone who's superior to me, I look for something, like some fault in them, where I can think that I'm better. There's this competition, isn't there? That we're trying to one-up each other. So the next part of the consciousness is that spiritually we are all equal. We are all the same spiritual quality. Now, some of us may be more spiritually realized than others, but we are all the same spiritual quality. Some of us are deeply asleep, some of us are fully awake, but still, we have equal value, equal potency. Now, the bodies we're in are certainly very unequal, but we as souls are equal. Then detachment from material things. If I'm not this body, if I'm not doing anything in this world, then what should I care whether I get things in this world or not? Whether people praise me or they blame me, or whether I have something nice to eat or not something nice to eat, or whether I'm sick or whether I'm healthy, or in the ultimate issue, it's just a computer game character, it doesn't really matter. So that's the next point of consciousness. Is those things are not should not be what's driving me. I shouldn't be thinking, well, I'm going to act to get happiness on the material platform, which generally means having a nice place to live and money and health and good friends and good reputation. Now, of course, people are very afraid that if they're detached from those things, that they'll be lazy or that they'll materially suffer. But Krishna's saying, no. You work with full enthusiasm, but you're not aiming for those things. And if you realize on the spiritual platform, you see that those things ultimately don't matter. You get your spiritual enjoyment within. We cannot be without enjoyment. Krishna is enjoying, and we are also meant to enjoy. So get real enjoyment. What is the use of enjoyment in a computer game? Doesn't benefit you, isn't it? If you make a lot of money in your computer game, it doesn't put any real money into your bank account. Have the real enjoyment within by connecting with Krishna within. Work for the welfare of everyone. And have actual peace. Have peace from knowing Krishna is the enjoyer of what I'm doing. I'm not doing my sacrifices so I can enjoy the result. I do my sacrifices so Krishna can enjoy the result, and I get my pleasure at Krishna's pleasure. That's how I'm designed. Just like I find a lot of pleasure at giving pleasure to my friends, or giving pleasure to my children, or even giving pleasure to a stranger on the street. So I'm designed to get my pleasure from giving Krishna pleasure. And he wants to give me pleasure, so I don't have to worry that I'm going to lose out. And this way I find peace. Because my pleasure is not dependent on my externals. We cannot be happy or peaceful if our pleasure is dependent upon our externals. Because as I was already saying, first of all, my externals don't have anything to do with me. How can I get real pleasure from something that doesn't touch me? I mean, I can eat as much food as I want in a dream, and I'm still going to be hungry. The next thing is I can't control my externals. Anybody here perfectly able to control all the externals of their life? Impossible. You know, I can work out at the gym every day and eat a great diet and then get hit by a car. I'm not in control. So because I'm not in control, I'm always in anxiety. Maybe something bad will happen. Maybe something bad will happen. And you know what? It will. Bad things will happen. Guaranteed, absolutely. I'll give you 100% guarantee that some bad things will happen in each of our lives, for sure. So if I try to take my pleasure externally, it doesn't touch me. I can't control the result, and I know bad things are going to happen. So how can I be peaceful? And if you can't be peaceful, Krishna says, there's no question of happiness without peace. You know, I have a cup of water here, but if it was somebody standing behind me ready to grab it away, it'd be hard to even enjoy drinking it. You can't be happy without peace. Peace doesn't mean boring. It means a sense of detachment. It means freedom. I'm not dependent on my external circumstances for my happiness and for my satisfaction. So now, how to come to this state? So Krishna describes what we usually think of as yoga. He says you can go away from people in general, you can practice breathing exercises, you can move your life air up through the chakras, don't have anything to do with the world in general, and in this way you can achieve this state of inner pleasure and inner peace and spiritual union with the divine. Not union in the sense of merging, union in the sense of love. And Arjuna, after hearing all this, he says, I don't think I can do that. He says, my mind's too restless to achieve perfection in that way. And what would happen if I fail? And Krishna says, don't worry. Even if you fail, you pick up in your next life. And then he says, really, the topmost yoga is to always just think of me with love. You don't need to do that kind of entering into trance by going into a secluded place. So then, all right, if I'm just going to meditate on Krishna with love, how can I do that? So Krishna explains, all right, well, there's me, there's the Lord, there's the you, there's the living entity, and then there's material nature. And Krishna says that he's the origin, the essence of everything. He gives a whole list of things. He's the origin of this, he's the origin of this. We can read a few of them. Yes. Fragrance of the earth, heat and fire, life of all that lives, penances of ascetics, original seed, intelligence of the intelligent, prowess of powerful men, strength of the strong, religious sex life, all states of being are manifested by his energy. That's chapter 7. So Krishna explains how he's the essence and the origin of everything. And then he says, everything is being run by the modes, but although I am behind them, people who don't understand my glories, they don't surrender to me. They don't work in harmony with me. So if you just, when Krishna says surrender to him, again, please understand this is a loving kind of surrender. It's the kind of surrender that husbands and wives do to each other, the kind of surrender that parents do to their children or friends do to their friends. It's not a battle, it's not this kind of surrender. It's not like what the Japanese did at the end of World War II. It's not, we don't mean like that. We mean rather that surrender is, I trust you and I'm going to work in harmony with your desires. So Krishna says, ultimately, to get rid of this illusion, to regain your spiritual nature, to become self-realized, to become enlightened, you just have to surrender to me. He says, even though it's that simple and I'm the origin of everything, there are some people who never surrender, and then there are pious people who do surrender. So pious people, when they're distressed, when they want some material happiness, when they're curious, and when they're looking for knowledge, they actually come to me. He said, but those who are foolish and who are atheistic, that no matter what happens, they won't come to me. And then Krishna says, others worship me in an impersonal way, or they worship the different gods within the universe. But ultimately, if you want real freedom, then you have to come to Krishna. And one who does that can know Krishna even at the time of death. So then Arjuna asks a bunch of questions, including which, well, how do I know you at the time of death? And it's quite interesting. I'm sure you're all familiar with people who have near-death experiences. You heard of people like that? Where, you know, they're on the operating table and their heart stops, but they have an experience where they leave their body and Some of them go to some higher realm and come back with other different kinds of experiences. So one such experience I was reading, the woman was saying that she realized that where we go after death is determined not just by what we think about and what we do during our life, but particularly what we think about at the time of death. She said, I had never understood before that our thoughts at that moment are very important. So Krishna explains this very clearly in the 8th chapter. He said, those who think of me only at the time of death will come to me, and otherwise people go wherever they think about at death. You know, it's not just what you think about at death, it's also what one has done during one's life. But why would that be so important? Well, many, many years ago, I took my students on a field trip, and when we came back, we saw billows of smoke in the sky. And the kids said, let's go see what that is. And we saw that there was an apartment house on fire. It was about a half an hour before the flames got down low enough so we could even check it out. And we saw a young woman on the sidewalk, barefoot, with three little children next to her. And I thought, oh, when the house is burning down, you don't get your shoes, you don't get your wallet, you know, you don't get anything except your children. How do you know what's really important to you is when your house is burning down? So that's the real test. Whatever we say is important to us, at the time of death, mentally, we're going to grab onto what's actually most important. That's how you know what your real values are. I was a friend of mine who died of cancer. He wrote that when death is coming close, it takes away everything that's false. You see who you really are, what's really important to you. Or one of my friends whose wife died of cancer, as soon as she got the prognosis that she was in stage 4 and no further treatment was going to work, there was a lot in her life she just stopped and never did again. Now, all of a sudden, it just wasn't important anymore. So the time of death shows what's really important. And if spiritual life, if Krishna consciousness is what's actually, if that's what we really want, because the world is designed, and a lot of people understand this principle to some extent, the world is designed to give us what we want. Eko bhavanam yo vidadatikam. Krishna's been fulfilling everyone's desire since the beginning of time. So if one really wants spiritual life, one will get it. If one really wants enlightenment, if one really wants freedom from illusion, one will get it. So Krishna is saying, if that's your focus, if at the time of death you think only of Krishna, you will go to Krishna. He says other people try to control their destination by dying at a particular time, by dying at a certain time of the year, a certain time of the day, taking advantage of the, just like if you want to drive, you want to drive when there's not much traffic. So there's times in the universe where if you die at a particular time, it's very easy to go to a certain path. But he says, actually don't worry about things. And just fix your mind upon me. And then Krishna explains that he's everywhere. He's everywhere and he's not everywhere at the same time. He controls everything, yet he's not responsible for what we do out of our free will. Again, if we go back to the computer game analogy. So somebody's controlling the computer game, but yet each person as the player decides what they're going to do. That if we know Krishna is the origin of everything, then we will serve him, again, serving out of love, and we will come then under the jurisdiction of divine nature instead of material nature. But there are those who want to serve something lesser. Maybe they want to serve some other celestial beings, or they want to serve some big person on this planet. And then they're going to go there. But even if you're not a perfect devotee, that Krishna will help you to attain his shelter. That where you go depends, where you want to go depends on your destination. Different paths have different results. And then Krishna says, wonderful verse. He says, Yat karoshi yat ignasi yat tahosi vidasi yat yat tapasasi kamteya tat kurushva amaratana. Whatever you do, whatever you offer, give away, whatever charity you do, do that to please Krishna. Actually, there's a very similar verse in the Bible in Corinthians. And then Krishna describes how he's the origin of everything. And if one understands this, he'll find great happiness by speaking about spiritual life, at which point Krishna will reciprocate in the heart, and he'll destroy all of the darkness in the heart and bring one enlightenment. And then Krishna also tells Arjuna, this is in chapter 10, there's also quite a few in chapter 9. In chapter 10, Krishna also tells Arjuna how we can meditate on him in this world. He talks about different categories of things in the world, and he talks about how the best of each category represents him. Of lights, I am the sun. Of stars, I am the moon. Of Vedas, I am the Samaveda. Of senses, I am the mind. Of living beings, I am the living force. Of bodies of water, I am the ocean. Of trees, I am the banyan tree, and so forth. So whenever we see something that's particularly great or wonderful or amazing, then we can think, oh, here is Krishna's energy. So then Arjuna says, now my illusion is destroyed. I understand things in their right perspective. And I'm very happy to hear your instructions, Krishna. But now I'd like to not just hear about how you're the origin and the beginning, middle, and end of everything. I want to experience it. So Krishna says, okay, but our relationship is that of a friend. And as long, Arjuna, as you see me as a friend, you're not going to see my great opulences. So let me give you the vision of the demigods, the vision of the celestials. And then Krishna reveals his form as the universe. All places in one place and all time at one time. All the different aspects of creation at one place, broken up into many, many, many thousands. So Arjuna could see past, present, and future at one moment, and he could see everything far away, near, all places at one place. So then Arjuna became very overwhelmed, and he said, Krishna, who are you? What is your mission? Krishna said, I am time. I have come to destroy everything. And then Krishna showed Arjuna what would happen in the battle. He said, actually, your side will be victorious. It is already destined, and you can just simply be an instrument in the fight. Then Arjuna said at the end, please, Krishna, show me your four-armed form and your original form. And at the end, Krishna says that if you want to see me as the universe or you want to see me in my original form, you cannot do this mechanically, just by studying the scriptures or by meditation or by giving in charity or by austerities. You can only see me through love and devotion. Then Arjuna asks Krishna, Krishna, should I just become enlightened by being devoted to you from the beginning? Or should I first go through some preliminary purification process and first realize myself, or first realize the impersonal and then realize you? And Krishna says, you know, if you take the other path of first trying to become purified, it's going to be very difficult. You're going to have a lot of trouble on that path. You'll have to do things that are unnatural. Better to just come to me from the beginning. And the best thing, Krishna says, is to always think of me with love. Which Acharya Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, Krishna there is describing Raghunuga Bhakti, or spontaneous, natural devotion. He says, if you can't do that, then practice fixing your mind on me. So wherever the mind wanders, as he's explained earlier, due to his flickering and unsteady nature, to pull it back and fix it on the self. Pull it back, fix it on the self. Pull it back, fix it. And if you can't even do that, if you say, oh, my mind is too wandering, then take your body and engage it in acts of devotion. Bring a flower to Krishna, clean the temple, offer your food to Krishna, chant the holy names of Krishna. By doing that, and especially by doing work with detachment, that Krishna is my boss, Krishna is my best friend, I'm working for him, one will attain the peace we talked about earlier. By getting that peace, one can fix the mind on Krishna. By fixing the mind on Krishna, then one will get great desire, because it will be so wonderful to fix the mind on Krishna, that one will always think of Krishna with love. Then Krishna describes the qualities of the saintly person, and he describes his qualities mostly as being equipoise, but also as being a friend to all living entities. Now, this is the second main place that Krishna has described the qualities of an enlightened person. He did so at the end of the second chapter. He's doing so again at the end of the 12th chapter. And he's going to do it again in the 14th chapter. So if you want to know what are the qualities I should look for in myself or others to see, am I becoming enlightened? You want to look at the end of the second chapter when Arjuna says, what are the qualities of a person who's in the transcendental consciousness? Right now we are at the end of the 12th chapter. You can read a few of these. And again in the 14th chapter. So at the very end of the 12th chapter, you start at 12:13. And the descriptions in all these places are very similar. Not envious, kind friend to everyone, doesn't think themselves proprietor, free from false ego, equal in happiness and distress, tolerant, always satisfied, self-controlled, engage in devotional service with determination, mind and intelligence fixed on Krishna. Doesn't put anyone else into difficulty, is not disturbed by anyone, equal poise in happiness and distress, fear and anxiety. Not dependent on the ordinary course of events, pure expert, without cares, free from pains, not striving for some result. Doesn't rejoice or grieve, lament or desire, renounces auspicious and inauspicious things. Equal to friends and enemies, equal poised in honor and dishonor, heat and cold, happiness and distress. Third time he said equal poised in happiness and distress. Fame and infamy, free from contaminating associations, silent, satisfied with anything, doesn't care for any residence, fixed in knowledge. And completely engaging themselves with faith. And if we go back and compare this in the second chapter, text 55, giving up all varieties for sense gratification which arrive from mental concoction when the mind finds satisfaction in self alone. Not disturbed in mind, even among the miseries, or elated when there is happiness, free from attachment, fear, and anger. Unaffected by whatever good or evil they may obtain, either praising it or despising it. So, all very similar descriptions. We'll get to chapter 14. All right, this concludes Krishna's talk on devotional service. Now Arjuna says, I want to understand what is matter. So this is very significant. First of all, most philosophies, most religious philosophies of the world, most spiritual philosophies of the world, there's not much explanation of what is matter. What is the material world like? And this is Arjuna's question. So Krishna says the body is like a field, and the self, the soul, is like a tenant, and the Lord is like the landlord. The Lord is like the owner. So this is the field where we sow our seeds of desires and our seeds of activities, which then bring forth different kinds of fruit. Now Krishna here in the 13th chapter describes knowledge as we're using the word knowledge, we're translating it as knowledge, the Sanskrit is jnana, but it's not knowledge in the way we normally use the English word knowledge. What Krishna means here by knowledge is a process by which you attain what we call knowledge. So you want to be careful of the terminology here. He's talking about jnana and jnaya. Jnaya, which we're translating as the object of knowledge, what should be known. And what they're calling knowledge, we'd more call knowing, the process of knowing. So when Krishna talks about knowledge or how we gain knowledge, and knowledge also here doesn't mean what's the capital of Argentina, which we're not saying that you should know that. You know, that's useful. But that's not what he means. He means wisdom. He means enlightenment. The knowledge we're talking about here, it's even beyond wisdom, but actual enlightenment. So he's talking about a process of knowledge, and he's not talking about just go to school and study hard and have a high IQ. But when Krishna describes the process of knowledge, and you'll find this in chapter 13, text 8 through 12, process of knowledge starts with humility. Well, that makes sense. I can't learn anything if I think I already know everything. First, I have to have a sense that maybe I don't know everything before I hear anything.
Pridelessness, nonviolence, tolerance, simplicity, approaching a bona fide spiritual master.
Well, that makes sense. How am I going to learn anything without a teacher?
Cleanliness, steadiness, self-control.
So this is, how are we going to gain enlightenment? How are we going to gain wisdom? It's more through character and detachment than it is through brute force of intelligence. Now, what should we know? What are we trying to know? We're trying to know, who am I? I'm the soul. Who is God? And what is the nature of this world? And Krishna says, just like he's always detached from matter, so the soul as part of him is also always detached, and should give up the desire to enjoy matter, which only brings entanglement. It doesn't bring satisfaction. And Krishna also says that nature is like the mother and he's like the father, and we're like the children. So he gave two analogies. One is, our body's like the field, I'm like the tenant, and Krishna's like the landlord. Another is, the body's like the mother, and Krishna's like the father, and I'm like the child. Then Krishna starts talking about how this material nature works. Oh, I should also mention that in chapter 13, again, Krishna says the soul's not really doing anything, it's just a witness. Then in chapter 14, Krishna says, now I'm going to tell you something better even than I told you before. Everything's working by the modes of material nature. So think of the modes of material nature as something like the three colored lights on a movie screen. So the modes of nature, we have goodness, sattva-gun. Sattva means true or good. Then we have raja, which means passion. Raja also means king. Then we have tama, which means ignorance. So goodness will make you happy, passion will make you miserable, and ignorance will make you into a fool. If you're in goodness, you go to the higher planets of the celestials. If you're in passion, you stay here. If you're as a human, if you're in ignorance, you become an animal, or you go to the lower planets. And a really simple way to understand goodness, passion, ignorance is, in goodness, you're doing good things, you're doing the right things for purification, for liberation, for enlightenment. If you're in passion, you generally do good things, but you do it for pride, for honor, for prestige, for material acquisition. Someone in passion is a good, pious materialist. They're materialists, but they're good, pious materialists. They give to charity, you know, they're a good citizen, they're responsible, they take care of their family. The epitome of the person in passion is the righteous king, not like the medieval kings, but like the kings in the fairy tales, you know, the heroes. And the epitome of the person in ignorance is a criminal. So someone who, they're a materialist, but they're a materialist in any, they don't care how they do it. It doesn't matter. You know, I want something for myself, and it doesn't matter how I do it. So basically, in goodness, you do the right things for the right reason. In passion, you do the right things generally for the wrong reason. And in ignorance, you do the wrong things for the wrong reason. And Krishna says that everything in this material world is governed by these modes. He says all three of them, though, will lead to rebirth. So even goodness is still material. So if there's any material happiness, it's in goodness. But even that is still material. And Krishna says that actually you should understand these modes so you can become detached from them, to have constant devotion to Krishna. And now this seems very difficult because this whole world is so complicated. It's something like a banyan tree. You all seen banyan trees? Do you have any banyan trees here in Southern California?
There's a couple of them.
Okay. So I know in Hawaii we have a lot of them. So banyan trees are very complicated. So this world seems like a banyan tree. It's so complicated. And Krishna says not just like a banyan tree, but like a reflection of a banyan tree in the water, like an upside down banyan tree. And no matter how you're trying to get out of the world, you can't do it. He said the only way is you have to be detached and cut down this tree, he says, with the weapon of knowledge. Again, by knowledge, we don't mean how to change the oil in your car. Or we don't mean, you know, how to do the quadratic equation. However useful those things may be. I'm not saying people shouldn't know how to change the oil in their car. But that's not the kind of knowledge he's talking about. He's talking about knowledge on the soul and knowledge of the modes of material nature. So how can we have this kind of knowledge? And again, Krishna starts talking about how to see it in the world. He says that I'm the light of the sun and the moon. I'm the fire of digestion in your body. I mix with the kind of airs going in and out of your body. And I am your remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. He said, so if you can understand me there and serve me with love, then you can get out of these modes of material nature. Then Krishna talks about two polarities, the divine and the demoniac. He talks about the most extreme of the degraded, those who are thinking, I'm powerful, I'm the enjoyer, I'm gonna destroy anybody who gets in my way, and just whatever I want, I'm going to take and enjoy, and I'm going to be the Lord of everything. And then Arjuna says, well, aren't there people in the middle? And then Krishna says, yes, there's people according to goodness, passion, ignorance. And he goes to a lengthy description of food and goodness, passion, ignorance, charity, sacrifice, work, worker, understanding. This is in the 17th and 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, explaining all different areas of life according to these three modes of material nature. And then again, Krishna says, really, what you want to do is cultivate transcendent knowledge and work as a loving sacrifice for Krishna. Remember, one is not the only doer. One is a witness. Although one's acting according to one's desires, as still there's material nature, there's the place, there's the Lord. Not to think that I'm the doer and the controller in this world. Instead, purify your work by doing it as an offering. And then Krishna says, you know, Arjuna, if you don't fight this battle, you're going to fight anyway, because that's your nature. You're a soldier, you're a fighter, you're a politician. Said your choices really are either do this transcendentally or do it materially. And if you do it transcendentally, you're not going to take birth again. You'll be liberated, you'll be enlightened, you'll be happy even in this life. And if you do it for your own personal desires, then you'll become entangled. Now Arjuna, Krishna says, I have told you everything. Now do whatever you want to do. And Prabhupada says there in the purport that Krishna was prepared to repeat the whole Bhagavad Gita if necessary. Now because Krishna really was very dear to Arjuna and Arjuna was very dear to Krishna, Krishna didn't stop right there and say, do whatever you want. But he said a couple things after that. He said, but please, always think of me and become my devotee. Which is interesting because he had said that same verse at the end of the ninth chapter. And then he says, just forget about everything else. Just surrender to me and I'll protect you. Don't worry. So that was, of course, beginning of, as soon as Krishna gave his first instructions in the role of Arjuna's guru, and his last instruction was, don't worry, I will take care of you. And he said that you should please teach this conversation to those who are not envious. Don't teach it to those who are envious. Anybody who teaches this, that person is most dear to me, and if you just study this sacred conversation, then you will worship Krishna by your intelligence. And then we have the person telling us all about the Bhagavad Gita, Sanjaya, who ends by saying, thus I heard the conversation of two great souls, Krishna and Arjuna, and so wonderful is that message of 1874, that my hair is standing on end. I heard these most confidential talks directly from the master of all mysticism, Krishna, who is speaking personally to Arjuna. As I repeatedly recall this wondrous and holy dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, I take pleasure, being thrilled at every moment. I struck with wonder more and more, and I rejoice again and again. Wherever there is Krishna, the master of all mystics, and wherever there is Arjuna, the supreme archer, there will also certainly be opulence, victory, extraordinary power, and morality. That is my opinion. So I hope you enjoyed this very quick tour through the Bhagavad Gita. So we can take a few minutes, 5-6 minutes. Maybe. Any questions or comments? Or... Yes.
Near the beginning, you mentioned that there are individuals who are pious, who will surrender to Krishna?
Yes.
And you mentioned that there's demonic individuals who will never surrender to Krishna?
Well, I don't know about never, but...
Okay. That was my question.
Not at the not in their present mood. So if you are, not you, but if a person is a fool, and by a fool we don't mean they have a very low IQ. We mean that they're interested in is materialistic things. They're spiritually foolish. If they're very sinful, if they're atheists, or if they're apparently spiritually or religiously inclined, but as Krishna puts it, their knowledge is stolen by illusion. So just like we see that there are even people who are apparently religious leaders or spiritual leaders, but what they're teaching is the opposite of spirituality. I'm sure we've all experienced that. So people who are in those four categories, they're not going to surrender to Krishna. Not now, anyway. They might surrender to Krishna in a few lifetimes. Maybe later in this lifetime. That's another thing. But as long as one's in that mentality, no matter what evidence is put before you and what experiences you have, you don't take up the real spirituality, as long as you keep that mentality. It's like any of those mentalities act sort of as a shield against truth. I mean, maybe each of us, sometimes we're in such a mood that we won't see the truth, no matter what's put in front of us. So, like, yes.
Beautiful presentation.
Thank you.
Early on when we were talking about doing the right thing for the right reason, I hope I'm not alone in occasionally really not knowing for sure if I'm doing the right thing for the right reason.
Oh, good.
And I'm wondering...
Well, that's a good start.
I'm wondering what the route to take is to feel that you're doing the right thing for the right reason.
Okay, that's an excellent question. Thank you so much for asking. Well, first of all, let's figure out what the right reason is. All right? The right reason, the top reason to do something is because it's going to give me my loving relationship with Krishna. It's going to make Krishna smile. Because Krishna is the absolute truth. You know, sometimes I hesitate to use that word because people think that I'm saying something like religiously fanatic. But he's the ultimate truth. He's the personality of truth. He is truth. So anything that pleases him is true. You can think of it like if you have a very beautiful dance with many people in it. So the choreographer has designed that dance. And anything that's in harmony with the choreographer is going to bring happiness. So because everything is designed by Krishna, in one sense everything is Krishna, anything that's in harmony with the truth is going to bring us happiness. So the best reason is that I want to be in harmony with the truth. Or what you think of another thing is, like if you have a machine, like I have this little machine here, this is a machine, it's designed to be used a certain way, and if I use it in harmony with its design, it will function well. So the best use of something is harmony with how that thing is designed to be used. Or, you know, if instead of drinking the water here, if I eat the cup, that will cause me distress because my body is not designed to eat paper. It's not in harmony with truth. So the best reason to do something is to want to be in harmony with reality. Prabhupada says the whole world is full of Krishna singing. So as to have what I do harmonize with that universal orchestra. I have my own voice. And you know, traditional Indian music is all improvised. It's not a pre-written score. But there's certain ragas and talas. And your improvisation stays within a certain boundary. So you can have I'm sure everybody's seen some improv, right? Or my daughter's does traditional Indian dance, and sometimes you have this dialogue between the dancer and the drummer, although they're both doing an improv. So it's not that there's actually, and the ultimate truth is spontaneous and individual and voluntary. It's not scripted, and it's not prescribed. So the ultimate best reason is to use my individual, spontaneous, and voluntary nature in a way that's in harmony with the singing of Krishna. So that is the ultimate right reason. That is the ultimate truth. That is what's absolutely true. Now, a little lower than that, but you could still say a right reason, is to act for my own purification and my own enlightenment. That puts you within the material sphere, which means it's not absolute truth anymore. It's relative truth, but it's still called goodness or truth. And why is it not absolute? Because I'm thinking much more about me. You know, when you're harmonizing with a concert, although you may be doing it in an individual, spontaneous, and voluntary way, you're thinking about the total harmony. You're thinking about how you're contributing to the total harmony, rather than focusing on being the prima donna in the middle. So mode of goodness, you're still thinking it's about me. But still, that's within the realm of illusion. The highest you can go is thinking, I'm doing this for my own purification and my own enlightenment. Then the top wrong reason is, I'm doing this so everybody can know that I'm a good person. That's motive passion. You're still doing the right thing, but now the motives are off. So whenever he says, I'm doing this because I'm going to watch how other people are watching me, what are they going to think of me? What kind of reputation am I going to have? What are they going to write in the New York Times about me after I'm gone? You know? So that's wrong reason. Now that may motivate you to do good things. You know, people give a lot in charity, and they help the planet, and they do all kinds of things, so they'll be known as a righteous person. And materialistic society really pushes this mode of passion. Our modern materialistic society considers it, and even most religious organizations in our modern world, they're pushing the mode of passion. Be a good, righteous person, right? When people talk about family values, they're talking mode of passion. Be a good person, do the right thing, so you'll be known as a good person and you can go to heaven. So then the worst of the bad reasons is, I'm doing this for myself and I don't care who gets hurt and I don't care what anybody thinks of me and I don't care what kind of reputation I have, you know, I don't care what happens, I'm just doing what I want to do now and who cares about the consequences? So that's the mode of ignorance. So to think of what's driving me, and to be willing to honestly see what's driving us, is a huge first step on the path of actually attaining to Krishna consciousness. It is not easy. We have been accustomed to deceiving ourselves about our motives, probably for a very long time. So it's not such an easy thing. But if you want to see, Krishna will help you. Jnana Dipena Bhashtava. He will show you. Krishna will never force you to change your motives. And he won't exactly change them for you. But he will show you what they are. And if you want to change them, he will help you. And he'll help you quite dramatically. And wonderfully also. Don't be afraid of it. It'll be very lovely. But you do have to be willing to see it. So I would say, ask Krishna, show me what my motives are. And you can ask Krishna to show you in a very gentle, private way. He doesn't have to tell all your friends. And then when you see that, if you see that your motives are less than what you would like them to be, which I think will happen more often, at least in the beginning, than we would like, and then you say to Krishna, I'm really sorry about this. Please help me to do things for the sake of real harmony and truth and love. And then how to know what the right things are, so for that one needs to have a guru. For that one has the scriptures where we're given, okay, these are, we're talking about externally. Well, how does one behave externally? Yes?
How do you play the various roles in your life? How do you fulfill your responsibilities and still be a good devotee? responsibilities and say I'm devotee of Krishna.
Oh, very nice. Arjuna did want to run into a forest and give a big responsibility.
Do that, but I somehow don't feel
so you're ahead of Arjuna.
I don't feel so much respect. I feel like a person should be well balanced, well rounded, and still could be an undercover devotee.
Of course. How do you do that? It's very simple. You just think Krishna is my boss. My boss is not my employer at the bank. My boss is not my husband, my father. My boss is not my government. Who else do we think is our boss? My body, sometimes I think is my boss. Krishna is my boss. Krishna is my company president. He's in a very nice business. What's Krishna's product? What is he selling?
Love.
Love! Would you like to work for that company? You get to eat the company product. So Krishna's selling love of God. And if you join up as an employee in Krishna's company, he will give you everything you need to do your job. He'll also pay you a salary. He'll even give you vacations. He'll give you everything you need. You won't have to worry about anything for yourself anymore. And then everyone you deal with in your life is now one of three things. Either they're a supplier of love of God, they're one of your vendors, or they're a co-worker, or they're a customer. So when you're dealing with your husband, you have to decide, is my husband a supplier, co-worker, or customer? When I'm dealing with my children, are they my supplier, co-worker, or customer? When you're dealing with your so-called employer, you decide, is this person a supplier of love of God, a co-worker, or a customer, or a potential customer? You might have to do some marketing, too. And whatever situation you're in, it doesn't matter what situation you're in. Whatever situation you're in, whether you're taking your child on a walk to the park, or you're washing the dishes, or you're driving to your job, or you're paying the taxes, whatever you're doing, I'm here on my company business. And my business is to try to sell love of God. And that doesn't mean you have to be a preacher. That's lovely if you are. But we're not just saying you have to be a preacher. And it's not that everywhere you go you have to convince everyone to buy a Bhagavad Gita. Well, that's also lovely. But that's not what I mean. You can sell love of God sometimes simply by being. What did St. Francis say? We should always preach love of God and sometimes by talking or something like that. Really paraphrasing. So that then you spiritualize all your duties. So I'm not doing this because, I'm not serving my husband because I am a wife. Sorry, you're not. It's just a role you're playing. It's not who you are. But I'm in this role. All right, here I am. So you think of yourself as a secret agent. I don't know if that appeals to you, but I was going to be a secret agent. So you think of yourself as a secret agent. You know, other people think I'm a wife and a mother and a bank employee and a college professor and this, but actually, I work for Krishna's company. And then, as Krishna says in the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, everything merges into transcendence. You, what you're doing, the offering, everything becomes spiritualized. Now, if you just want to have a balanced material and spiritual life, then you go to Swarga with the demigods. That's not enlightenment. So be careful. If you want to enjoy the material world as a devotee of Krishna, that is in the lower aspects of sattva gun, mode of goodness, and then you get to be one of the celestial beings in the universe, but you don't get out of here. So be careful. So our aim is not so much balance Our aim is to transcendentalize everything. Now, I do give a whole seminar called Material and Spiritual Balance, but one of the things I talk about is spiritualize everything. And no, you don't need to go to the forest. In fact, it's not even recommended. Of course, you can come to Hawaii with me. We have very nice forests there. I know we're going to live for a year in the forest. Yes. Sure.
You say that Krishna promised Arjuna that if you surrender to me, I'll protect you. So what kind of protection is talking about? That I've seen many great devotees, you know, recently die in a car accident or...
Everybody dies. So death, you know, if you're a kitten, then the bite of the cat on your neck is very pleasant. And if you're a rat, the bite of the cat on your neck is very unpleasant. So for the devotees, death is lightning and illumination taking place simultaneously. It's the way it dies. It's not that death in a car accident is more tragic than death by cancer. Or death by old age. Most people don't just like get old and die. They generally die of something. So if you're a devotee, then you know there's no such thing as death. It's just a change of clothes. Death is tragic only if you've invested everything into this false identity. If you've invested everything into your computer character and you don't have any real life, then when the electricity turns off, you're devastated. But if you have a real life, what does it matter? It's irrelevant. If you were there and you can play the game on a mission, and you never identified with the character, then what does it matter if the game closes down? Or the internet goes down? You have your real life anyway. Devotees have their real life. The real protection we want is to realize ourselves and have our actual life. Krishna doesn't say, if you surrender to me, I'll give you a nice illusion. If you surrender to me, you'll be free from illusion. You'll know who you really are. It's getting it. Yes?
So along the same lines, then, why do we have self-doubt?
Self-doubt.
Yeah, internally where we doubt ourselves, or you know, like I don't know, I can do that, or you know, or someone will say.
Yeah, because you have the wrong self. You're dealing with the false self. I'm getting a little late. I could, yes, sir.
On the definition of Maya, can you think Maya as material world or three modes of material?
What a fascinating question that we probably can't answer in a few seconds. Maya essentially means that which is not. Srila Prabhupada says in Krishna book, it's either in 13th or 14th chapter, he says that Maya only exists within the mind. It's basically a state of seeing things differently from what they are. The modes of nature are a vehicle that allows us to see things that way. The modes of nature are like the lights in a movie theater that create the illusion of the movie. But why are you watching the movie? Because you want to get away from reality. You want an illusion. I'm not saying you. Why do people go see movies? They want to be an illusion. So the origin of Maya is, I want to see something other than truth. I want to be in falsity. I want to experience something that's not real. I want to try to be the Lord. I want to try to be the center, but I'm not. Which we can't help but notice if we're just slightly observant. Nobody thinks that Ernie was the center except for me, you know. So if I want to be the center, I can't actually be the center. I can't. So that desire to be the center, that is Maya. It's something that it's not. And Krishna is so kind. You know, okay, you want something that's impossible, so I'll give it to you in illusion. You can't give it to us in reality because it's impossible. We couldn't all be the center. Yes.
Where and when do you give your seminars?
Here and now.
When is your next seminar?
I don't know. I'm probably going to give a morning class at the LA Temple a week from tomorrow, early in the morning. Probably. That's not definite yet. Probably. After that, I'll be going to Hawaii. I'll be in the Big Island for 5 weeks, and when I'm in Hawaii, I give classes over Skype, which I think is 6:30 Hawaii time, should be like 9:30 here. If you check ISKCON-Hawaii, you have to look at ISKCON-Hawaii Big Island, not ISKCON-Hawaii-Honolulu, ISKCON-Hawaii Big Island. You can see the times there. After that, I'll be back here for 10 days. I don't have anything scheduled then, and then I'll be in India for a few months. And I'll be giving classes, Krishna will, in Vrindavan, India, in September, October, November, and I don't have any plans after that right now. I'm working on my plans after that, or someone's working on my plans after that, and I will know when I know. If you go to ISKCON Desire Tree, you'll find audio recordings of a lot of my classes and seminars here. Go to ISKCON Desire Tree Audio, ISKCON Matajis. And you'll find them there. Thank you very much for having me here. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Staying and taking some of the